This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's episode. I'll be talking about the Israel lobby today with Stephen M. Walt, the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Relations at Harvard University. He's a columnist at Foreign Policy magazine and the author of several books, including The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Stephen Walt, welcome to Understanding Israel-Palestine.
Nice to be with you today.
Some listeners of this program know the term the Israel lobby, but for people who may not follow U.S. foreign policy or attend much to U.S. politics, could you explain what constitutes the Israel lobby and what led you and your co-author, John Mearsheimer, to write about it?
Sure. The Israel lobby is a loose coalition of different groups and Americans who actively work to maintain a special relationship between the United States and Israel, a relationship of essentially unconditional U.S. support for Israel, no matter what it does. This is a pretty familiar phenomenon. It's not any kind of conspiracy or Kamal. It's an interest group like many other interest groups we have in the United States, like the farm lobby or the NRA or Big Pharma or whatever. And these are people, some of them Christian evangelicals, some of them American Jews, who spend part of their time or all of their time trying to influence American policy to make it more supportive of Israel. These groups don't agree on everything, but they all believe that the United States should be backing Israel more or less unconditionally. And so I'm thinking of groups like AIPAC, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, the American Jewish Congress, and some other groups as well. Those are the kinds of groups I'm thinking about. Christians United for Israel would be another example from the Christian evangelical side of things.
For listeners who may not be familiar with the term, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee is better known by its acronym, AIPAC. How does the lobby work and how did it become so strong? Your book notes that in the 1950s, the U.S. had a pretty normal relationship with Israel. President Eisenhower was not intimidated by it when Israel, Britain, and France invaded Egypt after President Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. The United States, the United Nations, and the Soviet Union forced those countries to withdraw from it. Israel seems to have taken on more and more salience in our foreign policy. How did that happen?
Well, it was a gradual process. Partly it is because Americans did have a sort of traditional support for Israel, which they saw as an underdog, a beleaguered state. So some of this was naturally building on sympathy and also the sympathy that Israel garnered in the wake of World War II and especially the Nazi Holocaust as well. But the growth of the power of the lobby takes decades, and it's built over time, originally a rather small operation in Washington, D.C., working primarily on Capitol Hill, but over time building it into a larger organization. And it works the same way that other influential lobbies do in other areas. AIPAC has lots of people busy on Capitol Hill, going to congressional offices, providing them with talking points, trying to shape elections by steering money to candidates that are seen as more supportive of Israel and against candidates who seem to have a more skeptical attitude or a different attitude on that by writing papers. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a research organization or think tank connected to the lobby, producing position papers and books and articles designed to shape public opinion. So there are all the usual ways in which a lobbying organization tries to build support. And then finally, by attacking anyone who questions their views, questions the American relationship with Israel, or criticizes aspects of Israeli policy, those people can almost be guaranteed that they'll be attacked in public and in print, designed to marginalize or smear them as somehow anti-Semitic or unfair or anti-American. The usual tactics that happen in the rough and tumble of American politics.
Your book makes clear just how special the quote-unquote special relationship between Israel and the United States is. Despite being a prosperous country, Israel has been for decades now the largest beneficiary of U.S. aid. In addition to receiving close to $4 billion a year, most of that now in military aid, it receives all sorts of special favors that no other country receives. Unlike any other country receiving foreign aid, it receives all of its aid in one lump sum at the beginning of the year, which allows Israel to collect interest on the funds it's not yet spent and requires the United States to borrow money, costing U.S. taxpayers between $50 and $60 million a year to make that payment. Israel receives so-called loans, which it frequently doesn't have to pay back. Unlike other countries which receive aid for specific projects, Israel does not have to account for how the U.S. aid it receives is spent. It gets its aid when Israel sells U.S. military technology to potential adversaries such as China, when it annexes territory, I'm quoting you from your own book,
right,
when it builds new settlements, when it reneges on promises made to U.S. presidents. You talk about how that constant flow of unconditional aid to Israel might be thought to translate into leverage over Israel, but in fact, the U.S. rarely, if ever, demands Israel comply with its requests, that carrots are always used instead of sticks and the carrots are always additional aid. Well, surely people in the State Department, in the administration, in Congress must recognize how aberrant this is. Is it that the lobby is so strong, or is it that people in Congress and in the administration are pusillanimous?
Well, those two things aren't unrelated. And the fact is that it doesn't advance your political career until recently. Things have, I think, shifted somewhat in recent years. But certainly at the time we were writing the book, it doesn't advance your political career at all to take a critical stance towards Israel. Among other things, in the book, we quote a number of politicians, Bill Clinton, Ernest Hollings, and others, Barry Goldwater back in the day, who talked about the power of the lobby and how it shaped U.S. policy. But they waited until after they had left office to say this. It wasn't something that was politically astute to say, precisely because it could really affect your electoral chances. And there were a number of cases of U.S. politicians who took a more independent stance, nothing particularly bold or dangerous, and certainly nothing that should have been controversial, but then suffered political setbacks, in some cases losing elections. And that was a lesson to everybody else. Another way to put this is that there is a powerful set of pro-Israel groups in American politics, and there's really nobody on the other side, nobody arguing a counter position. There is no well-organized, well-funded Palestinian lobby. So if you're a congressman, you gain nothing by taking an independent stance, and you might actually face some significant opposition there. It's not that so much that many congressmen have been pusillanimous. It's a combination of a very powerful interest group and the fact that politicians want to get reelected. I think that also explains, of course, why presidents and diplomats, State Department officials, and others who understand how this works and are pretty clear about it as well, but they won't say that in public. They understand this isn't necessarily good for the United States, and many of them understand that this hasn't ultimately been good for Israel either, but they won't say so because, again, the political opposition that they're likely to face could derail their other political objectives and undermine their political positions.
When you say it's not good for Israel either, do you look at the new governing coalition in Israel and think the United States has paved the way for this far-right government to come into power by being so deferential to Israel?
Yes, but they're, of course, not the first here. I mean, I think we have to go back 30 or 40 years. I mean, I think many people have understood that the continued occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people was a long-term threat to Israel, certainly to Israel's character as a democratic state. You can't be a legitimately democratic state when you're ruling over millions of people and denying them all political rights and effectively establishing an apartheid system in the occupied territories, as the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem now has claimed, as Human Rights Watch has asserted as well. And people have understood that this was a long-term problem. But what allowed it to continue was the fact that the United States was providing support and diplomatic backing, diplomatic protection, vetoing dozens of resolutions critical of Israel in the UN Security Council. And by the way, these are resolutions that aren't questioning Israel's right to exist, Israel's right to be a secure and prosperous state. Nobody is opposed to that. They were criticizing the occupation. They were criticizing criticizing the treatment of the Palestinians, and yet the United States would veto them. So in a sense, we've insulated Israel for decades from the consequences of its policies. And one result of that is that Israel has steadily drifted towards the right to the point that not only is it losing its democratic character because of the way it denies Palestinian subjects political rights, but it's also maybe losing its democratic character given the emergence of more authoritarian or autocratic movements within Israel itself. And of course, the recent controversy over the proposed judicial reforms that would significantly weaken the power of the Israeli judiciary and move it in a more authoritarian direction. This has provoked, as you well know, enormous protests in Israel from people who want it to remain a democratic state. But the point is that that long-term trend has been, I think, facilitated by the unintended consequence of the unconditional support that the United States has provided. And that's unconditional support that is largely the product of the Israel lobby's influence.
For two nights in a row now, Israeli police in Jerusalem have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and beaten Muslim worshippers. Coordinating with Israel, the Biden administration has blocked a statement from the UN Security Council criticizing the Israeli raids, which have triggered rocket fire from Gaza and Lebanon. The Biden administration has refused to condemn the police attacks on worshippers, but it has condemned the rocket attacks coming from Gaza and Lebanon. This seems a very current and pertinent example of the U.S. relationship that you've just been talking about. Acquiescence to behavior that, if it was done by any other country, would be condemned as outrageous. I'd like to get your response to this particular episode and then ask, how does the Biden administration have the gall to lecture other countries about human rights or the rules-based order or democracy when it provides impunity to Israel for its serious and ongoing human rights violations? Is credibility something that doesn't really matter in foreign relations?
This is a very large and interesting question. Certainly, credibility does matter, although you're absolutely right. We often, you know, are told that if we don't stand up to an autocrat or a dictator someplace, our credibility will be shot. But of course, if we say something and then don't stand up to an ally or a friend, our credibility isn't affected at all. There's no question that the United States is being deeply hypocritical here. And every time the United States stands up and talks about the importance of the rule of law and the importance of the rules-based order, when Antony Blinken becomes Secretary of State and says he's going to put human rights at the center of a U.S. foreign policy and then turns a blind eye to what's happening in Israel-Palestine and a number of other places around the world, we immediately are, I think, seen as being hypocritical. When the United States holds a democracy summit, tries to rally the world's democracies, and then again turns a blind eye to what Israel is doing, that undercuts the message pretty considerably. I think that what the Biden administration is doing, though, is not unusual. It's not any different than the way the Trump administration approached the Middle East. It's not really all that different from the way the Obama administration approached it. President Obama, in his first year, was very outspoken about wanting to see an end to settlement construction and really wanted to push for a two-state solution. And he realized by the end of his first year that if he did that, he wasn't going to be able to get his other priorities through the Senate. He wasn't going to be able to get Obamacare passed because he would lose some votes over that issue. And he backed off and at the end of his administration had achieved nothing. But there was nothing unique about the Obama administration. Bill Clinton was in favor of a two-state solution. But as you said earlier, all he did was offer bribes to Israel to try and get them to move to a two-state solution. No sticks at all. Sticks were reserved for the Palestinian side. And of course, that was true under George W. Bush as well. So you have three American presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, who all are fully committed to a two-state solution and would have liked to have seen that come about. But they all failed to achieve it. And the principal reason they failed was that they were unwilling to put real pressure on Israel. And the reason they weren't willing to put pressure on Israel was that they feared the domestic political consequences here at home.
If you're just joining us, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to Stephen M. Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School, about his book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Do you think the two-state solution is still viable?
No, I say that with real regret because I think all the alternatives are less attractive than that. But I think, given the political trends within Israel itself, given the number of settlements that have now been constructed and the way in which they have been located and constructed in order to prevent the formation of a viable Palestinian state in the West Bank, given all of that and the considerable political problems within the Palestinian community as well, I think that's no longer a real option, and therefore the world is eventually going to have to confront what the different alternatives are, none of which look particularly attractive to me.
When you say none of them look particularly attractive to you, could you outline what those
Well,
are?
so if you're not going to get a two-state solution where you have a viable Palestinian state able to live on its own and be secure against Israel, with Israel also secure against that Palestinian state, you don't have that, then what are your options? You can have a continuation of the current situation, which is effectively one of apartheid, where the Palestinians are denied political rights and are totally under the control of the Israelis. So that's not viable. I think as a long-term attractive solution, it's hard to be publicly supportive of that. Or you could imagine another round of ethnic cleansing. You would try to expel as many Palestinians as possible from the West Bank. That's a war crime. That's a crime against humanity. So you can't really support that as a viable option. And the third option is the one-state solution that Palestinians give up the desire for their own state, but they say that they want political rights, full political rights within a greater Israel. And Israel could retain much of its Jewish character, but it would now be a binational state. Now, when you think about it, that's attractive from a purely idealistic point of view. Americans would say, well, you know, we're not in here in the United States supposed to distinguish between ethnicity, race, creed, things like that. Everyone should have political rights. But I think if you look carefully at examples of other binational states, and particularly binational states where there is a history of conflict, a history of enmity between the two peoples, they don't work particularly well. So, you know, you can sort of think of the one-state solution as maybe a long-term objective, but it's not a particularly attractive objective. It might not work well at all. So as I look at the alternatives to a two-state solution, they all look less appealing to me. Unfortunately, because of the policies that the United States and Israel have followed for the last 30 or 40 years, that may be where we eventually end up, even though I think it's filled with potential problems.
This spring marks the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I want to ask you about that war and the influence of the Israel lobby on that war, which you and your co-author John Mearsheimer say was considerable. Some Americans assume that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was about oil, but the two of you say there's really not much evidence that the oil industry played much of a role in promoting that war, but there is evidence that concern for Israel was a factor. Could you talk about that?
Sure. The first point to make is that the Israel lobby was not the only factor that led to the war. If you hadn't had the 9/11 attacks, for example, I don't think you would have had a war on Iraq. President Bush, Vice President Cheney were independent actors. They ultimately made the decision as well. So the Israel lobby did not cause the war by itself. Had the circumstances been different, you would not have gotten a war. That said, a hardline faction within the sort of broader Israel lobby and so-called neoconservatives came up with the idea. They conceived the idea of attacking Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein, and they pushed it relentlessly from the mid-1990s forward. As Tom Friedman of the New York Times told an interviewer some years later, Iraq was the war the neoconservatives wanted, the war the neoconservatives marketed. It was not dreamed up by the Defense Department. It was not dreamed up by the State Department. The intelligence community didn't come up with this idea. It was neoconservatives, almost all of them, very deeply committed to Israel. Israel, in fact, itself was initially wary. They wanted the United States to focus on Iran. But once the Bush administration had decided to focus on Iraq, the Israeli government got behind it, and key Israeli officials helped sell it here in the United States, writing op-eds and making media appearances. And then finally, the key organizations within the Israel lobby, groups like AIPAC and others, lobbied on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. The president of AIPAC, Howard Korr, actually said the year after the war began that it was one of their achievements of the year, was quietly lobbying for the war as well. Now, the other point I just want to emphasize is that these were people who did not push this war because they thought it would be good for Israel, but bad for the United States. They thought it would be good for both countries. They thought getting rid of Saddam Hussein would make Israel safer and would also improve the American position in the Middle East. And of course, they were tragically wrong on both counts. But I don't really regard this as disloyal behavior on their part. I just regard it as strategically foolish. And it's unfortunate that the neoconservatives were able to have such a powerful impact on George W. Bush, they convinced him to go to war.
I want to ask you more about Iran. You've been critical of the U.S. stance towards Iran. The U.S. has been subjecting Iran to draconian sanctions since the Trump administration took the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal. Israel has been very against any possible rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran. What's been the role of the Israel lobby in promoting those sanctions? What's the role of the Israel lobby in promoting war with Iran? If the U.S. were to go to war with Iran, would it mostly be on Israel's behalf? Would it serve any U.S. strategic purpose?
I don't think so. I think it would not be in America's interest to have a war with Iran at this point as well. Let me say two things. First of all, it's very important to recognize when we talk about this subject, when I talk about the Israel lobby, I'm not talking about the American Jewish community. So in the case of the Iraq War, for example, if you looked at public opinion polls of American Jews, they were less supportive of going to war against Iraq than the American people as a whole. Right. So the lobby is separate. It's a group of individuals within that community and in some other communities who have a particular set of political views, but don't necessarily represent the broader community. Now, turning to Iran, the organizations in the Israel lobby, like AIPAC and others, have been staunchly opposed to any rapprochement between the United States and Iran since the 1990s. And here they've really kind of marched in lockstep with the Israeli government. When there was a brief effort in the 1990s under the Clinton administration to maybe try and improve relations gradually with Iran, they were dead set against it and put pressure on Clinton not to go forward. They put pressure on the Bush administration as well to have a very uncompromising approach towards Iran. The Obama administration faced enormous obstacles, of course, in negotiating the nuclear deal with Iran and couldn't get a treaty because they would never have gotten that through the Senate, had to do it as an executive agreement. And then, of course, as soon as Donald Trump came in, he tore that deal up. The consequence, though, of all of this policies is, of course, is Iran has gotten steadily closer over a 20 to 25-year period to having nuclear weapons. Iran had zero nuclear centrifuges in operation in the year 2000. When the JCPOA was signed, it had over 15,000. The agreement cut them back, cut them roughly in half, removed much of their stockpile. Once we left the agreement, of course, they began enriching uranium net and are now closer than ever to getting a bomb. So the policies that the Israel lobby has advocated for towards Iran for many, many years have had exactly the opposite effect. It hasn't made Iran weaker. It hasn't improved relationships with Iran. It hasn't increased American influence in the region. Remember, the war in Iraq actually helped Iran by removing its principal regional rival from the situation. These policies have actually been terrible for the United States, but they also haven't helped Israel either. And that, to me, is one of the key points people have to understand about how damaging the impact of this particular lobbying group has been, not unlike some other interest groups one could identify in American politics.
Your book was published in 2007. So much of what you write about the Israel lobby clearly describes the situation both then and now. Has there been anything about the lobby that's changed since you wrote your book? Do you see any signs of it weakening or modifying in any way?
Yeah, I think there have been a number of important developments. I mean, one is that this was kind of a taboo subject when we wrote the book. Even talking about the Israel lobby openly would get you attacked in various ways. And now I think it's become a perfectly normal thing. You see it in articles in the New York Times and elsewhere, people talking about the power of the Israel lobby. So in a sense, it has been demystified. It becomes like talking about the National Rifle Association or talking about the influence of the American Medical Association on healthcare. Things like that. And that's a good thing. Second, the strategic and moral, and especially the moral case for unconditional support for Israel has gotten progressively weaker. And this is a consequence primarily of the occupation, the behavior of the Israelis in general. So the gap between unconditional American support and this idea that we are two closely aligned countries that share identical values, etc., that's become a much harder argument to make over time. And one sign of this is, of course, that the Democratic Party has become increasingly divided on this. I would say you sort of have old guard Democrats like President Biden, like Chuck Schumer, like Robert Menendez, who's chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you know, been in office for decades. They still have kind of the old attitude towards Israel. This is our friend. This is our ally. We have to support them no matter what. But that view is no longer held nearly as widely by younger politicians, particularly in the Democratic Party, and by younger Americans, including many younger American Jews who are no longer as reflexively supportive of Israel. So that's all changed in fundamental ways. U.S. policy has not changed yet, but I think the sort of signs are on the wall that it's going to be increasingly difficult to sustain the kind of special relationship that we've had in the past. And that, in my view, is why you also see even more energetic efforts made now to silence discussion on this issue, to promulgate definitions of anti-Semitism that equate criticism of Israel in any form with being anti-Semitic, which of course is absurd. Right? You can criticize the policies of a country without criticizing the nature of the people or criticizing co-nationals or co-religionists elsewhere as well. And of course, this is happening because the objective case for unconditional support is getting weaker and weaker, increasingly hard to defend. And when that's the case, you just have to try and shut down discussion. I don't think that's going to work, by the way. And then the final thing that's happened is you see a number of prominent American Jews, intellectuals, many who are strongly supportive of Israel, but becoming increasingly critical. I'm thinking here of people like Eric Alterman, Peter Beinart, and others who are, and Tom Friedman of the New York Times, who's written a number of things in recent years that are clearly quite heartfelt, quite emotional, and very worried about the trajectory of the country. All of this, to me, is signs that the kind of reflexive support that has characterized American policy is going to be much harder to sustain over time.
Democracy has sometimes been perceived as helpful in curbing states' willingness to go to war, but the influence of the Israel lobby or the Cuban lobby reflect how foreign policy can be influenced, even possibly determined, by special interest groups and sometimes militant special interest groups. What's the cure for this? Is it more democracy, getting the general public more involved, or campaign finance reform?
Well, if I had a magic wand and could do campaign finance reform, I would do it, because that would fix a lot of this problem, not just in this subject, but in lots of other areas of our politics. But that's a bridge too far here. I do think the solution is, in a sense, more democracy, more open discussion, not silencing critical voices, paying more attention to them as well. And I also just would caution listeners against the belief that being a democracy makes you less likely to go to war. There's no evidence to suggest that democracies are less war-prone than non-democracies. They tend not to fight other democracies, but they both fight as many wars as autocracies do. And in fact, I'm sorry to say, democracies historically have started as many wars as non-democracies have. So democracy itself is not the solution to the problem of war. A more effective democracy here might keep us out of a few foolish ones, however.
Stephen Walt, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Nice talking with you too.
That was Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard University's Kennedy School, the author of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, and more recently, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine. My interview with Stephen Walt was recorded April 7th. If you'd like to hear the full interview, you can listen to the podcast or go to our program page on the KKFI website and listen online at kkfi.org.